For the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, this is a review of John Suchet's The Last Waltz. Each episode is enriched by beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. Last week's episode saw us through some of the personal events of Emperor Franz Joseph's life, culminating in the suicide of his only son, Rudolf. This tragedy was to have dramatic consequences on the future of the dynasty. John Suchet writes, "There had already been one death in the imperial family. The emperor's brother, the Archduke Maximilian, who had been installed on the throne of faraway Mexico, had been executed by firing squad in June 1867. It was to be the first in a series of tragedies in the imperial family. There had been ups and downs, but the continuity of the dynasty for 600 years had never been interrupted. With Rudolf's suicide, this had come to an unnatural, sudden stop." Franz Josef, known to his people as Der Alte Herr, was well-loved, very popular in Austria by his people. At this stage of the book, Suchet, who is really a music expert, gives us the story behind Strauss's masterpiece, the Kaiserwaltz. Taking what he calls a certain artistic license in comparing the bars of this famous piece of music to the emperor's life. Soon after his 40th jubilee, the emperor made clear and evident approaches of friendship to the German Kaiser. Strauss was not one to lose an opportunity to make himself agreeable and lose the chance of more fame. He composed a piece which he named Hand in Hand. However, his Berlin publisher came up with the idea of calling the piece Kaiserwaltz, thereby flattering both the Habsburg Emperor and Kaiser Wilhelm II, who had recently risen to the throne. The adulation that Strauss received for this piece of music goes beyond the imagination. The dramatist Paul Lindau wrote that in the opening bars of the Kaiserwaltz, there is more music, genuine, unalterated music, than in many operas that last a whole evening, but which leave the heart empty. Thank you. The music critic Wilhelm Ritter described it as the most beautiful flower the fantastic tree of Strauss's music has borne. Pages now reveal the expertise of John Suchet, the music expert, describing bar by bar this famous piece of music, from the pianissimo of the opening bars to the gradual crescendo to the piano and the forte. Very significantly, John Suchet creates a simile between the highs and the lows of the changing rhythm of the Kaiserwaltz and the ups and downs of the Emperor Franz Joseph's life. So, the high violins and flute drift down to the melancholy phase, he writes. There can be no relief from the melancholia that sits on Franz Joseph's shoulders. But the emperor knows, and so do his people, that in the end he will be overwhelmed by fate, by forces he cannot control. The march is abruptly cut off, and the lone voice of the cello returns like a Cassandra, with nothing to impart but prophecies of more tragedy to come. Then, in the end, with the dignity of a soldier, he faces his fate. The music built to a fortissimo finish. Nothing will break this man.
The Kaiserwalzer is perhaps Johann Strauss II's most famous work, and for good reason too. In the autumn of 1889, the year following the 40th jubilee of Emperor Franz Joseph's reign, Strauss composed a new waltz called Hand in Hand. It was one of the pieces he intended performing in Berlin at a week of concerts, and the title was meant to echo a recent toast of friendship that Franz Joseph had made to the German Kaiser. However, Strauss's German publisher, Fritz Simrock, had a rather better idea. He suggested that the title of the waltz should be renamed to Kaiserwalzer, a title which could be a reference to either monarch. This could be interpreted as a suitable flattery to both monarchs. Simrock decided to go ahead with this plan, and the waltz is probably the best one that Strauss ever composed. It is full of the expected pomp and pageantry, but at the same time there are poignant parts of it which call for reflection, and at times a twinge of sadness. As soon as the waltz was published and performed, tributes began flowing in from critics and commentators of the day. The Swiss music critic William Ritter described the waltz as overtly symphonic, more of a tone poem than dance, and the most beautiful flower the fantastic tree of Strauss's music has become. In a letter written to Strauss, the German dramatist and novelist Paul Lindau said, "It is no exaggeration when I say that in my musical view, nothing has been written since the days of Franz Schubert, which for pure and unspoiled beauty can be compared with the first part of the Kaiserwalzer. The opening is in fact a slow march, which is different to what may be expected in normal marches. This is slow, majestic, and rather pompous, but at the same time it is also tinged with nostalgia. After lifting the music a little, everything returns to piano, after which we have a full-blown march that moves along merrily and with a stately pomp. Strauss then introduces a solo cello to proceedings, and with a tempo di valse written at the top of the score, we progress to another rather nostalgic part, where the emperor is almost remembering better days, with, as Suchet writes, a controlled sob. There are further waltzes in the work, some depicting the military precision of Franz Joseph, others recalling the joyous character of the emperor, who remains so notwithstanding all the misfortunes and tragedies which befell him along the way. The Kaiserwalzer remains one of the most endearing pieces written by Johann Strauss II. It uncannily describes the character of Emperor Franz Joseph in more ways than one, and its immortality in the waltz canon is assured.
Let us go back to Johann Strauss. It seems that the musician knew his emperor quite intimately through Kathi Schracht. Kathi had been accepted as the emperor's official mistress. Franz Josef had bought a villa for her in the Gloriettergasse, just outside the Schönbrunn in Heitzing. Here the emperor joined her frequently, letting himself through the garden gate for breakfast. Johann Strauss, the locals said, often joined them later in the day. How much more friendly could the King of Walzer and the Emperor get? Well, a rare occasion is recorded that underlines the friendship between them when the emperor stayed on in the royal box at the theatre to the end of the Gypsy Baron to say to the composer, "I enjoyed myself immensely, Herr Strauss. You know it is strange, but your music ages as little as you do. You haven't changed at all in the long years I have known you. I congratulate you on your opera." He had referred to Strauss's operetta as opera, thus paying the composer the highest compliment possible. They had known each other for 50 years. The emperor had aged, a careworn face, balding, elaborate sideburns and moustache, stooped from personal cares and worrying matters of state. Johann Strauss, who was 5 years older, looked much younger, dark-haired, sprightly, darting eyes, nattily dressed, almost restless. Suchet's writing now enters a more domestic sphere, and he tells us about Johann Strauss Jr.'s likes and dislikes, about his hobbies and his friends. We learn that he did not have many friends and did not particularly enjoy social life and tried to avoid official occasions, escaping after performances as fast as was possible. Yet, he made an effort when it was diplomatically correct to do so. Here Suscha makes a comparison with Johannes Brahms, notoriously curmudgeonly. The two musicians became very close friends, notwithstanding that they were as different as chalk and cheese. In Suscha's words, the two more contrasting individuals, both as men and musicians, would have been hard to find. Their music, too, was worlds apart. Brahms's works were deep, even dense, an exercise for the profoundest intellect. By contrast, Johann Strauss was a showman who wrote music primarily to entertain. In a few words, the explanation for their profound friendship is simply that opposites attract. The friendship between the two was encouraged and nurtured by Adele, who they both adored, writes Suscha, obviously on different levels. Both musicians spent their summers at their respective villas at Bad Ischl, southwest of Vienna by the River Traun, opposite the Imperial Villa, where Franz Josef could be seen strolling in the company of Kati Schrack, the uncrowned Empress of Austria. At this stage of the book, John Suscha delights us with images that complement his descriptive paragraph. We are shown a recent photo of the Café Sauna, which was frequented by Kati Schracht, who used to be joined there by Brahms. Page 195, we have a very sharp photo of the two musicians, Strauss and Brahms, standing together on Strauss's terrace at Bad Ischl. The contrast between the two is strikingly evident. Strauss, who was close to 70 years old, is smart, slim, his hair dyed dark black, elegant in checked trousers and wearing an elaborately knotted tie on an immaculate white shirt. He seems to smile under his large, fashionable moustache. By contrast, Brahms, who is about 6 years younger, looks much older. His grey hair receding, and a bushy white beard adding years to his age. He wears a creased loose coat and frowns somewhat short-sightedly at the camera. Appearances may conceal the truth. In reality, Strauss was a very highly strung person. He was nervy and hypochondriac. His fear of death and illness turned him into a moody person, described by contemporaries as morose and speaking. He would sulk for days or weeks on end. His own wife hardly dared speak to him then, since to be disturbed in his ill-humoured silence would bring him to furious agitation. Composed mostly at night, standing up at a tall desk. This habit affected his eyesight, so much so that around the time of his Golden Jubilee celebrations, he wrote to his brother Edward, "I see everything double. If I should have the misfortune to go blind, I shall shoot myself. Of all physical ailments, this is the most insurmountable. Not to read or be able to write would take away from me all the joy of life." Life had given Johann Strauss Jr. much, a great talent, fame, and the worship of his admirers. He was wealthy and respected by the highest in the land and beyond. He may have been morose, and he may have suffered from psychiatric illness, but one thing is certain, he was a true son of Vienna, and to Vienna he owed more than he could ever repay. It does him justice to see that he was aware of this and lost no chance to acknowledge it. Suchet writes, "Strauss's music distills the essence of Vienna into musical notes, and Strauss knew it." During a banquet held at the Grand Hotel in Vienna for his Golden Jubilee, Johann Strauss was to salute the city of his birth, saying, "If it is true that I have some talent, then I have to thank for it my dear native city of Vienna, in whose earth my whole strength is rooted, in whose air lie the sounds which my ear gathers, which my heart takes in, and my hand writes down." Vienna, the heart of my beautiful, God-blessed Austria. To her I give my cheer. Vienna, bloom, prosper, and grow. We shall see in the episodes that follow that the future was not to be so rosy, that more tragedy would touch the life of Austria's Emperor Franz Josef, and that as he aged, so did Austria head inexorably towards a tragic end. The Strauss family's success had reached its zenith, and it too would face inexorable decline. Once more, I wish my listeners goodbye, and until the next episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories, The Last Waltz, I thank Gerald Fennec for his participation. I also thank the technicians at Campus FM for their support.